Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to the program. My guest today is award-winning journalist and author Andrew Nicky Falk. For the last two decades, Andrew has written about energy, economics, and the West for a variety of Canadian publications and received seven national magazine awards from the Association of Canadian Journalists. In the late 1980s, he investigated the social and ecological impacts of intensive livestock industries and the legacy of northern uranium mining for the Calgary Herald. His dramatic Alberta-based book, Saboteurs, Weibo Ludwig's War Against Big Oil, won the Governor General's Award for Nonfiction in 2002. His latest book, The Tar Sands, Dirty Oil and the Future of the Continent, published by D&M Publishers in Canada and co-published with the David Suzuki Foundation, examines the world's largest energy project, and it recently won the 2009 Rachel Carson Environmental Book Award. It was also listed as a finalist for the Grantham Prize for Excellence in Reporting on the Environment. Andrew Nicky Falk joins me now from Calgary. Welcome, Andrew.
Hello there, Helen.
Hello. Look, I've known about the coal tar sands in Canada for some time. I have been in Alberta, which strikes me as one of the most backward states in any civilized country. I've never met so many climate change skeptics, including the professor of anatomy there, who you would think would be well-read and well-educated. And I am going to go to Peace River, where they want to build nuclear reactors to mine the coal tar sands. But I have not, till I read your report in the Greenpeace report about the coal tar sands, and I haven't read your book, I'm sorry, realised the massive undertaking that Canada's doing with the coal tar sands and what a dreadful, dreadful thing it is to the global warming situation. It really negates everything, doesn't it? Do you want to just start on that note, Andrew?
Well, yeah. Let's start with the scale of the project, Helen,
yeah.
Because it is enormous. We have, and the resource is really what we call bitumen.
And bitumen, that like what you put on roads.
What you put on roads, essentially, it smells like asphalt, it looks like asphalt, and it behaves like asphalt.
Right.
And what it really was, at one time it was light oil. It's been really badly degraded by bacteria, and the bacteria has taken out the hydrogen and added all kinds of carbon.
Oh.
And so now you've got this tarry goop. And this was over, we're talking about hundreds of millions of years here that this all happened.
Right.
But now we have these deposits in northern Canada that cover an area of about 140,000 square kilometers.
That's
like the southwest corner of Western Australia. That's, essentially the size of Tasmania, or it's larger than Tasmania. It's an area larger than England. It's an area larger than North Carolina. And we've known about this stuff for more than 100 years.
Yeah.
At one time, Aboriginals actually used the bitumen to repair leaky canoes. The Hudson Bay Company used it to repair roofs and trading posts and that sort of thing. But now it is, as we run out of light oil around the world, industry has come knocking and has really begun to rapidly develop this resource.
Now, what's the difference between light oil and heavy oil, Andrew?
Well, there are a lot of differences. First of all, it doesn't take as much energy to produce light oil.
Why? Because it's less viscous?
Well, it's just easier to produce. I mean, you drill a hole in the ground, and then you pump the oil out, bring it to surface, And because it's light and it doesn't require much refining. Mm. Now, heavy oil, in contrast to that, it's much heavier. It has a very different gravity. And has difficulty even moving through pipelines in some cases, and it requires extensive refining. In other words, you've got to take some of that carbon out in that heavy oil and add some hydrogen.
Make it thinner.
Make it thinner, indeed. And bitumen is almost another substance altogether. It has an extraordinary gravity. I mean, it is so thick and so viscous that it will not move through a pipeline unless you dilute it with light oil or natural gas condensate. And then, you know, once you've got it moving, it requires enormous upgrading because it is so carbon rich and hydrogen poor. And then once you've upgraded it and you then have something called synthetic crude, it then has to go through a really complex refinery because synthetic crude has got 8 times more sulfur than light oil.
Oh,
it's got
nasty.
More heavy metals. It's got more acids, and so it's another energy ordeal to refine it into marketable oil.
Well, how do you separate it from the sand in which it's sort of embedded?
Well, there are two ways to do that, and in both involve brute force. I mean, we've got these huge open pit mines in northern Alberta, just north of Fort McMurray. And, you know, these mines are, some of these mine sites cover an area of 200 square kilometers.
My God.
Yeah, and it's not, they're not all developed at once, but that Imperial Oil has got a new mine site called Curl, the Curl mine site. And that's the lease. The lease occupies 200 square kilometers. Now, these are among the world's largest open pit mines, and essentially what you do is you cut down hundreds of thousands of trees.
Oh yeah, you
drain every fen, every bog, every all the muskeg, all the rivers, all the streams. Then you roll back the earth or overburden, as the engineers call it, and then you get digging. And about 20% of the bitumen deposits in Canada are shallow enough to be mined this way. And it takes about 4 barrels of bitumen to make, four tons of earth and sand to make 2 tons of bitumen. And
4 tons of earth and sand to get out 2 tons of bitumen.
That's right.
Okay.
And then that 2 tons translates roughly that 2 tons of sanding then translates into essentially 1 barrel of oil.
So
So every day the tar sands are mining enough material to fill, you know, Yankee Stadium or a complex like that. And so we're using 400 ton trucks and huge electric shovels to mine this low grade ore. Now the other thing that's really important about the mining operations are that they are really water intensive, and so you get this tarry black stuff out of the ground that looks like asphalt, and then essentially you have to put it through a washing machine, and where you add caustic soda, and that's to separate the bitumen from the sand and the clay, and you create an enormous waste stream, and as a result we have about 130 square kilometers of tailings or toxic waste on either side of the Athabasca, north of Fort McMurray now in northern Alberta.
What's the Athabasca? What is the Athabasca?
Well, the Athabasca River is in a very, you know, it would be like, not quite sure, but it's a larger river than the Murray, let's say, in Australia.
Or in the United States?
In the United States, you would compare it in some ways to the Missouri River.
Right.
But it's a bit smaller than the Missouri.
Right.
And anyway, it's a very important waterway that runs through northern Alberta and feeds Canada's largest, or one of the world's, the third largest watershed. That's the Mackenzie River Basin. So the Athabasca feeds into Lake Athabasca and a number of other lakes, and then eventually into the Mackenzie River, and then into the Arctic. And it's part of a basin that protects about, you know, a sixth of Canada's fresh water supply. So here we've built, you know, the world's largest concentration of mining waste, these tailings ponds, occupying about 130 square kilometers on either side of the Athabasca River. These ponds are all unlined. They are made out of sand. They are all leaking. And there are great concerns about, you know, the contents of these ponds getting into either the Athabasca River or into groundwater. And, you know, the waste product from the hot water extraction process are, you know, the stuff like cyanide, stuff like polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, naphthenic acids, and you know, they're fish killers and cancer makers.
Okay, now, so I guess they take the water out of the Athabasca River and combine it with the coal tar sands, and then it all has to be heated, doesn't it? Steamed up to separate the bitumen. Where does the energy come from that, for that?
Well, okay, now, maybe before, I should talk about the other process here. We've got the open pit mines, okay, so
right.
that's one deal.
Using a hell of a lot of fossil fuel.
It uses a lot of fossil fuel, absolutely. Yeah. The energy intensity of this is again, vastly different than that of light oil.
Right.
And but then the other process is even worse. It's much worse than the open pit mines. And these are the steam plants. So you've got really, really deep deposits of bitumen. And the only way you can access them is to drill down and to inject pressurized steam into these chambers, and with the idea of melting the bitumen, and then you have another pipe below the formation that collects the melted bitumen and brings it back to surface. Now, this is a really horrendously energy-intensive process that uses, let's say, four times more natural gas than even the open-pit mines use, and it uses enormous amount of groundwater. In contrast, you know, the open pit mines use all of the most of their water comes from the Athabasca River. That's largely an unsustainable practice at this point in time. But the steam plants, which would really, you know, they will eventually occupy an area in business as usual, an area the size of England, and they will disrupt the hydrology of that region by withdrawing enormous amounts of groundwater, much of it saline, but nonetheless it will. By creating this vacuum in the ground, either from the using water or taking the bitumen out, they will really change the hydrology because you create an empty space in the ground and sooner or later it's going to fill with water. That water will either come from surface formations or from groundwater formations.
So the steam that they inject in is coming from the Athabasca River?
The steam that they inject in is there. First of all, they pump groundwater up, and then they use natural gas to boil up that groundwater, and then they inject the steam into the ground. And then they recycle some of this water, but not all of it, and some of it is lost in the process. And so they have to keep on adding enormous amounts of groundwater. Now, the big issue, though, here really is that if all of these steam plants go through and are built, these plants will require extraordinary amounts of groundwater to keep them going. And, of course, it takes energy to pump that groundwater. It takes energy to boil it up. It takes energy to inject it. It takes energy to recycle it.
This is why
the extraordinary thing about this the steam bitumen is that it takes about one barrel of oil or oil equivalent to create three in the steam plant. And, you know, in contrast, for light oil, at the turn of the century, it took one barrel of energy to produce 100. Now, in the Middle East, it's about one barrel of oil to produce 20. And here we've really gone down the chain for one barrel to produce three.
I thought I read somewhere where in toto, the whole process, you use the equivalent of four barrels of oil to produce one barrel. Is that wrong?
No, that's wrong.
Okay, so it's you use one barrel of oil to produce three barrels, whereas in the past it was one barrel of oil to produce 100 barrels of oil.
That's right. At the turn of the century, yeah. So you can see the energy economics have completely changed here.
Oh.
You know, we're expending more energy to get less and less and less. It's a bit like the world's fisheries. You know, we're expending more and more energy to capture smaller and smaller fish.
Yes.
And so, you know, we're reaching a really critical point in terms of our consumption of hydrocarbons. And, you know, with the rapid development of this resource is telling us, you know what, guys, your consumption of hydrocarbons is no longer sustainable, and you must begin in the transition very, very quickly.
And where does the natural gas come from, Andrew, to power these steam generators?
Well, the natural gas comes from all across Western Canada. It comes from shale gas and sour gas deposits in British Columbia and in central Alberta. It comes from coal bed methane fields. And so here's, you know, another disturbing consequence of rapid development of the tar sands is that it requires more and more natural gas drilling. This drilling is taking place on Aboriginal lands, is taking place on agricultural lands, is taking place on Crown lands, with the result that more and more land is being fragmented, more groundwater is being hydraulically fracked, and more farmland is being disturbed and diminished by natural gas infrastructure, whether it be well pads or pipelines or whatever. So you've got a whole other cost added to the tar sands, and that comes from natural gas drilling throughout Western Canada.
And, of course, natural gas is the preferred method of heating houses and the like because it produces 50% less CO2 than burning oil to heat houses, right?
That's correct. And the tar sands today consume enough natural gas every day to heat 6 million homes in Canada.
That's obscene.
It is obscene. It's an obscene consumption of natural gas, and it is totally unsustainable. But get this, I mean, Helen, the solution that industry has forwarded is that, all right, we understand that this now, we can't keep on burning one fossil fuel to create this dirty hydrocarbon called bitumen. Why don't we build a couple of nuclear reactors in Alberta and have them generate the electricity and steam we need for the steam plants? And, you know, as a result, there are, you know, 3 to 4 proposals now to use nuclear power to accelerate the production of fossil fuels in northern Canada.
I'm interviewing author Andrew Nikifork, whose latest book, The Tar Sands, Dirty Oil and the Future of the Continent, examines the world's largest energy project in Canada. Let's get into this nuclear reactor business. I first learned about this last year when I went to Alberta and learned that they want to build 2 huge nuclear reactors at a place called Peace River, if you please. It absolutely took my breath away, but then I see in some of your writings they're actually proposing 25 nuclear reactors to get out this this oil.
Yes, I mean, that's one group. One research group here in Calgary has proposed as many as 25 nuclear reactors. Actually, the Canadian government, or Canadian Parliament, in their report on the tar sands, about 2 years ago, calculated that, look, you know, that the project is using so much natural gas that if we were going to keep everything on track and get to 3 million barrels a day, and right now we're producing more than 1 million barrels, then that would take 20 nuclear reactors to do that. So we have, you know, estimates anywhere from 20 to 25 nuclear reactors. We have companies like the French nuclear giant Areva saying that, you know, Canada's tar sands boom is a real boost for nuclear power. And so there are all kinds of lobbyists and all kinds of business groups that have come up with the rather strange idea that, you know, the bitumen production is going to create a nuclear renaissance in Canada, and it's going to solve our carbon problems and solve the intense energy needs of bitumen production in northern Canada, with the result that we now have proposals in regions like Peace River, which is one of Canada's most northerly agricultural frontiers and a very beautiful part of northern Canada. And it's being proposed there for steam plant production and also for bitumen that is locked in carbonate, which is kind of bitumen, not locked in sand, but bitumen that is locked in rock. And the idea for production there is that you would need electrodes. You would sink the electrodes into the carbonate formation for 2 to 3 years. You would heat up that rock to 600 degrees Celsius. And the electricity that you would need to do that would have to come from a nuclear reactor if you wanted to do it right. And Shell has enormous leases in the region for carbonate shell that can only really be produced this way. So that seems to be the plan at hand.
Shell is a Dutch firm, isn't
Shell
it?
Is a Dutch firm, yes. It's interesting, Helen, because this is kind of gives you a clue on how important the tar sands are now. If you're an oil company, you know, a third of the remaining reserves that Shell has on its books are all in the tar sands. So in other words, if there were no tar sands, Shell, as an oil company, would be going out of business at this point in time.
Now, have you looked, Andrew, at the carbon footprint of nuclear power per se, the whole nuclear fuel chain?
I've looked at it a bit, and actually there have been some really good Australian studies on this. And of course, I mean, nuclear power is not carbon-free. The greenhouse gas emissions derived, from uranium mining, milling, enrichment, and fuel manufacture are substantial. They're increasing as the quality of uranium ores declines around the world. And, you know, and we haven't done enough research on this, but nobody can really say that nuclear power is now carbon-free. It's not.
It's not. And I think the seminal study was done by Storm van Leeuwen in Holland, along with an American called Philip Smith, who has since died. And they worked out the whole energy necessary for the creation of nuclear electricity to be 30% of the CO2 produced by a similar-sized gas-fired plant at the moment, one-third. But within the next 10 or 20 years, as you point out, Andrew, the uranium ore declines in concentration, a nuclear power plant will produce the same amount of CO2 as a similar-sized gas-fired plant. So, in fact, nuclear power adds substantially to global warming.
So it's kind of a technological solution that creates its own problems or adds to the problem.
I think Einstein had a lovely quote. Let me see if I can find it here. Einstein had a lot of lovely quotes, but he said the significant problems we face cannot be solved at the same level of thinking we were when we created them.
And I think he's absolutely right. You know, there's a number of writers and researchers who recently have talked about what they call sort of the hydrocarbon techno-institutional complex.
Yeah.
And they refer to the fact, and nuclear energy, I think, has got its own complex. It's its own group of high priests who are sort of saying, look, this is the solution. But for hydrocarbons, it's rather extraordinary. When you think about, okay, the addiction began about 100 years ago. It's created all of these technologies and institutions that have co-evolved and they work together. And quite often, their solutions to the problems created by the consumption of hydrocarbons, calls for more hydrocarbon production, but not surprisingly. And quite often, the nuclear industry works, I think, very much the same way. It's another technology with its own advocates, its own lobby groups, incredibly, they have seen an opportunity in bitumen production that is just mind-blowing. I mean, whatever you might think about nuclear power, I mean, it is still the most expensive form of electricity generation on the planet, Even to consider this economically is kind of fiscal madness all by itself.
And also, into the costs of nuclear power has never included the transportation and storage of radioactive waste for a million years. Now the EPA calls for regulations for a million years storage, nor the health impacts which society will have to pay for down the time track with epidemics of cancer and genetic disease. So those costs are never included. Okay, let's talk about the amount of CO2 currently being produced by the exercises at the coal tar sands in Canada, and how the Canadian government is trying to cover that up, and what contribution those CO2 outputs make to the whole global warming situation.
Okay, well, right now the tar sands, it really is the world's most carbon-intensive hydrocarbon, and it's very much a signal of what will happen if we, you know, start producing dirtier and dirtier fossil fuels as we run out of light oil. So the tar sands per se right now, I mean, they create about 36 million tons of CO2 or CO2 equivalent every year. And so, you know, and these numbers sometimes, I mean, they kind of boggle the mind, but it's like, okay, so what does that mean? Well, you could fill 76 million homes with that amount of carbon dioxide. And so what does it mean in terms of Canada? Well, it's about 5% of our emissions at this point in time. And then, you know, you've got the industry and government will say, you know, but globally, it's just a drop in the bucket. And of course, you can diminish the importance of anything by expressing it in global terms. Mm. But the tar sands really are a significant contribution, or really are a significant carbon problem at this point in time because, okay, 36 million tons, that's where we're at right now. So we're creating, this project alone is creating the same level of emissions that you'd expect from countries like Lithuania or Estonia. But by 2020, this project will be creating emissions on the level of Austria or Portugal or Austria or Belgium, you know, a country of 10 million people. By 2020, it could be emitting more than 140 million tons a year. You know, that's more carbon dioxide than all of the world's entire volcanic activity. Now, the problem that the really serious climate change issue here then is, number one, if this project serves as a model for the development of other unconventional hydrocarbons, then the world is really going to get sunk. Then we will reach a tipping point for dangerous climate change. So if we take this model, the irresponsible fiscal and environmental regime that Canada has for the tar sands, and apply it to oil shale in Colorado or oil shale in Australia, dangerous climate change is pretty much assured on this planet. The second really important effect the project has had is really how it has taken Canada out of the climate change debate in global terms. We've always been a natural resource nation. I mean, that's what we do. We take natural resources, we develop them, we don't add a lot of value to them, and then we export them. I mean, in Australia does very much
similar things,
right?
We're the same.
Third, right? You know, same.
Third world country, yeah.
We're a third world country with first world living standards,
right.
and we hope to continue those living standards by actually doing things we should not be doing. So the Canadian government has become very much a defender of this project. The Canadian government looks upon this project as critical for economic prosperity of the country. The project now employs 250,000 people. It will generate nearly $1 trillion for GDP by 2020. And the federal government makes an enormous amount of money every year from this project in the form of corporate taxes. None of that money, I might add, is being saved for future generations. So as a result, you know, Canada is now a petrostate, and Canada, you can't become the number one supplier of oil to the United States. And we occupied that position now for 7 years. We export more oil to the United States than Saudi Arabia or Mexico.
Oh, really?
Yes, absolutely. We're number one. And about 19% of the oil that the United States imports now comes from Canada, and the majority of that is coming from the tar sands. So as a result of this incredible development in Canada's national life, I make the argument that this is a nation-changing event for Canada. And one of the evidence I point to is really, you know, one time we used to have a, a fairly credible record when it came to environmental matters. We had really good record on air pollution, but that's all gone with the rapid development of the tar sands since 1996. And, you know, so this is why we will not meet our Kyoto targets. This is why we are now arguing against low-carbon fuel standards in the United States. This is why we are now seen as an obstacle to talks in Copenhagen by people like Sir David King, the chief former chief science advisor in England. And this is why we've been called obstructionist in any number of international negotiations. This is why we don't send our climate change scientists to international climate change meetings. It's
really?
Why our prime minister is, it explains why our prime minister, is pretty much a climate change denier, as well as being the son of an imperial oil executive, and as well as being a politician from Alberta, which is the center of this fossil fuel development.
Say no more.
in some ways, it's actually changed positions, Helen, with the United States. I mean, the United States now has a president that recognizes that, you know what, we've got two big problems here. We have a fossil fuel addiction, and we have the climate change consequences of that addiction. And now in Canada has now, you know, become sort of the George Bush of the North, where we're saying, you know, wait a moment, we're not sure about this climate change business. And, you know what, this is a really important resource, and we really want to develop it. And you know what? You Americans should be grateful for this resource. And if you're going to start imposing standards or taxes or then you know maybe we'll just open a pipeline out west to the port of Kitimat so we can start exporting bitumen to China because China's not going to ask as many questions about this resource. So there you have it. I mean, Canada is not quite the country we imagine it to be. And has become really a defender of the development of dirty fossil
fuels. Of global warming.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm interviewing Andrew Nikifork, an award-winning journalist, and his latest book, The Tar Sands, Dirty Oil and the Future of the Continent, won the 2009 Rachel Carson Environmental Book Award. And I would suggest that all Canadians listening to this program buy the book ASAP, and all Americans as well, and Australians, to learn what's happening to our planet. Now, two other major questions, Andrew. When you talk about the amount of CO2 that this process is emitting to the atmosphere, does that also include the burning of the coal, the tar that is extracted, or the oil that is extracted, or is it only the extraction process that you're talking about?
It's only the extraction project that I'm the production that I'm talking about. I don't and part of the problem here and is that we really don't have good transparent data on all of the emissions coming out of the tar sands. In particular, we don't really have good data on the production phase. You know, we can make rough estimates on the consumption phase because I mean, once you've got once you've upgraded the bitumen and turned it into synthetic crude, and once you've got and you've turned refined that synthetic crude into marketable oil, that you know we know what the emissions are going to be when you burn them.
Yep.
So the scale of the problem here is disguised by the fact that Canada has not really got good data on all of this at this point in time, and I think that's a significant issue for Canada.
Oh, absolutely. Now, so what's the mood of Canadians in general about this, Andrew, and how much do they know about it, and what role is the media playing?
Well, I mean, Canada is a very regional country, and in different parts of the country, Canadians are having different debates about this project. I would say generally Canadians think that, you know, this project is an important economic driver in the country, but it's enormously dirty, and that we've got to do something to clean it up. If you go to British Columbia, for example, you'll find there's a huge debate taking place about this proposed pipeline across northern British Columbia that would take bitumen from the tar sands to the port of Kitimat or Prince Rupert, so that 300 super tankers could take this raw bitumen to markets in Japan, Korea, or China. And, you know, the British claimants are asking, but do we really want to do this? And should we, you know, sacrifice 1,000 salmon-bearing rivers and the security of the West Coast so that we can put more cars on the road in Shanghai? So, but, you know, do we want to do that?
Mm.
And how many jobs will be created if we do it? And in Alberta, there's a growing debate about the competence of the government that is running this whole project.
Oh, sure. I've met a few of them, including the Minister for Energy.
they're rather a remarkable bunch.
Yeah.
And typical of any petrostate. And many of them, you know, would qualify as Sarah Palin clones. And you go to Saskatchewan, and the debate there is really about, well, do we want to put nuclear power plants in our northern running rivers in order to keep the tar sands going? If you go to northern Canada, the Northwest Territories, you'll find that Aboriginal communities are asking hard questions about living downstream from the project and the project's impact on water quality and quantity. If you go to Canada, in Canada, to you know, places like Ontario and Quebec, which are our manufacturing sector, and you'll find that there's great growing debate there about the impact of the petroloony created by tar sands development, and the fact that the manufacturing sector is being hurt by our rising petrodollar, and how they can contend with that fact. And then if you go to Atlantic Canada, there's a totally different debate there, and that's where most of the labor force in the tar sands has come from Atlantic Canada, which is an impoverished part of Canada. And more than 340,000 people have actually moved west to Saskatchewan and Alberta to take part in the tar sands boom. And so, I mean, they're concerned about the social issues. They're concerned about the bust and boom taking place in the region. And they're also concerned about the fact that Atlantic Canada has no energy security. It is completely dependent, 100% dependent, on foreign oil from the North Sea, North Africa, or the Middle East. And so they're saying, you know, here we are, we're taking part in this huge mega project that's providing, you know, a little more energy security for the United States, but nothing for our own home.
Right.
So, you know, so right across the Canada, across Canada, then you have this very complicated and very, very interesting debate taking place at a regional level. You know, so in each and every region of Canada is looking at this project, you know, differently.
Okay, so Andrew, Nikki Falk, talk about the problems with carbon capture and storage. This is the great unknown and the great savior of burning coal and burning oil for energy. Talk about the problems associated with carbon capture and storage.
Well, there are lots of them, and in Canada right now has chosen carbon capture and storage as a saying, look, this is going to be our white knight. This white knight will save us from the enormous emissions from the tar sands and from the fact that we don't have a climate change program, and that the fact that we have no renewable energy program of any quality or any scale worth mentioning. And so we're going to put all of our eggs in one basket, and it's going to be with carbon capture and storage. You know, the first question, so what is this, you know, marvelous technology that's going to save the day? Well, when you look at it, you realize, the number one, it's a pretty primitive technology. It's largely designed for coal-fired plants.
Yes.
And the idea is that you strip your carbon streams from these plants. By the way, and it takes an enormous amount of energy to do that.
What does stripping mean?
The stripping is as you're burning coal, you're creating these CO2 emissions, and the emissions have lots of other stuff in them, but you just want to take out the CO2, and then you have to compress that CO2, and then you've got a transportation system for that, and then you're going to inject it in the ground, and you have to find a safe place to bury it. So really, it's kind of a funeral service for carbon.
Yep.
Again, you have to monitor this funeral service for thousands of years. So once you found a place where you can store it, such as an old oil formation or a salt aquifer of some kind, then you really have to monitor for it for thousands and thousands of years. Now, the first problem with this is that, number one, there is no commercially operating project anywhere in the world that is doing this successfully in any form that would be considered even remotely economic.
Right.
So that's the first problem. The second problem is that any carbon capture and storage technology that is currently designed actually increases fossil fuel consumption by one-third.
Why?
So in other words, a coal-fired plant has to burn a third more coal in order to strip out the coal and transport it, inject it, compress it, and bury it.
Yeah.
So that's kind of extraordinary in itself. You know, and now there are then, you know, then come the basic economic questions. I mean, really, this doesn't make any sense economically until you carbon is at least $150 dollars a ton. We're not there yet. The second thing is or the next issue that's really important is the issue of scale. And Canadian energy expert Vaclav Smil, who works at the University of Manitoba, an absolutely brilliant fellow, argues that carbon capture and storage would require an infrastructure base twice the size of the world's current crude oil infrastructure industry.
Oh, my God.
Just to bury 25% of the world's carbon.
25%?
Okay. Now, it would take, you know, this undertaking would take, you know, decades to accomplish and hundreds of billions of dollars to do. Now, so it doesn't seem to work on a scale level. The next comes the issue that's really critically important, is of leakage, okay? And, all right, so you think you can find a safe place to store this carbon, only to find out that a lot of these storage sites aren't as safe as we thought, and because they have to be safe for thousands of years. And so typically we want to bury this stuff in old oil and gas fields. Well, you know, in Western Canada, the Western Canadian Sedimentary Basin has more than 350,000 wells have been drilled in that basin. Mm-hmm. I mean, the basin is a pincushion.
Mm.
So the fear is that if you bury this carbon underground, and at first it will sort of expand and balloon up and go cover, you know, tens of thousands of kilometers, depending on where it's being stored, that sooner or later it's going to hit an abandoned a gas well or oil well and leak to the surface.
Mm.
So there are enormous questions about leakage and the security, and then there are enormous questions about the potential for significant groundwater contamination. And they haven't been answered. You need a pretty incredible regulatory regime for all of this. We haven't got it yet. And, you know, I know that there's quite a debate in Australia about this because,
yes.
I mean, this is certainly the Australian government has thought, well, carbon capture and storage will solve some of our problems, too, because we're an energy-producing nation and we're an energy exporter, and we need to deal with some of these emissions from our coal and from our natural gas production.
Yeah, well, there are two other problems, too, that carbon dioxide can be released in a huge burp from the ground, underground storage, and if it's in a fairly populated place, it could kill a lot of people, number one. And number two, there's been work lately published that it's possible that carbon capture and storage could induce earthquakes.
That's, and in fact, that's been known for a long time. I mean, the oil and gas industry in Alberta regularly induces earthquakes in the areas where they are active. Yes. And in fact, one of the areas that you'll be going up to, Peace River Country, there's in British Columbia, there's a community called Fort St. John, and where the industry has withdrawn so much natural gas so quickly from the ground that they have induced any number of earthquakes in that region, you know, some of them two or three on the Richter scale. The largest earthquake ever recorded in Alberta was the result of actually an oil water flood where we were using water to flood an old oil formation to produce more oil, and that caused an earthquake of 4 on the Richter scale. So if you're pumping millions and millions of tons of CO2 into the ground, in all likelihood, sooner or later, you will trigger an earthquake somewhere at some time, and with the result that you might have a fracture that would simply release all of that CO2 that you put in the ground.
And also carbon capture and storage won't be pragmatic for at least another 20 years. So they're whistling in the wind because we've got to stop producing CO2 now. I mean, we actually are at the tipping point, according to some of the most knowledgeable meteorologists, including James Hansen, in the world. So all the stuff we've been talking about today, Andrew, is sort of hypothetical in terms of what we must do, like right now, to save many species on the planet, including ourselves.
Well, it is. And what we find is that, you know, most of the solutions being offered at this point in time are solutions from, you know, what I called here the kind of hydrocarbon techno-industrial complex.
Yep.
So the solutions are coming from the same people who created the problem. And use the quote from Albert Einstein, that's not the kind of thinking that we really need at this point in time.
Yeah.
And one of the things that troubles me, and, you know, and basically I'm a business journalist here in Canada, so I write a lot about business, and is that the whole idea of reducing consumption or reducing demand, nobody wants to entertain that idea, which is really the most economic solution for all of us. You know, if the Japanese and the Europeans can live quite comfortably consuming a third of the oil the average Canadian uses, then why don't we go there? And why don't we come up with policies that would get us there? And if Canada, if 10% of Canada's greenhouse gas emissions come from leaky oil and gas infrastructure, then why don't we go there and repair that leaky oil and gas infrastructure? That seemed to me would be much cheaper than carbon capture and storage. And you know, so there are so many things that could be done that we don't want to do because we don't want to talk about this word conservation. We don't want to talk about the fact that we might have to reduce consumption. And this to me is somewhat puzzling. It's more than puzzling because I think it's actually quite dangerous. And the danger here is that the average person in Canada and the United States is not aware that we have begun to switch from light oil to bitumen. And they aren't aware of the environmental sacrifices that comes with that. They aren't aware of the capital sacrifices that come with it. I mean, bitumen is the world's most expensive hydrocarbon. It costs between $60 and $80 a barrel to produce this stuff. If it's coming from a steam plant, that's not sustainable.
And also, Canada is a country aching to be used for renewable energy. I mean, imagine the amount of wind in Canada, let alone the amount of sun that can be harnessed, let alone tidal power and let alone geothermal energy. I mean, you could become the energy superpower of the planet if only the politicians could stop listening to the business people that you referred to and actually listen to the alternative business people who are making much more money out of renewable energy now than they are out of fossil fuel and nuclear.
Yeah, but in order for that to really happen in Canada, that a number of things have to change. Mm. And I think the dynamic here that most environmental groups misses is the fact that, you know what, if your government is making a hell of a lot of money off the production of hydrocarbons, and that gives them money to do all sorts of things, to behave badly, to behave well, whatever, it's cheap and easy revenue for a government. And it's very difficult for government in Canada at this point in time to imagine what the revenue sources might be from renewable energy. And so it's easy and convenient for them to remain with hydrocarbons and to defend high carbon producing sources, and as a result, that, you know, the entire debate in Canada then about renewables and then about supporting renewables and about climate change becomes incredibly compromised. And I think Australia is sort of in the midst of that too.
Oh, we are.
At least you have had at least some debate and some recognition that, you know, the production of hydrocarbons just can't go on forever and ever, and that you've got to get off them. But, you know, the really hazardous thing here is the fiscal power of these resources over government.
Well, and we're killing the earth to make money, let's be frank. I mean, as I look at it from a physician's point of view, it's like injecting a patient with potassium chloride to kill them, but I'm making a bit of money by doing it. The whole concept is actually insane.
Well, I think people are beginning to to wake up. I think they're beginning to realize that we are sacrificing the next generation. And funny enough, I think it's the Americans that are really going to force this debate. I mean, the Americans are looking at this oil and they're saying, well, you know, we're really glad to get off bloody oil from the Middle East, but you know what? We're not quite sure if switching to dirty oil is the solution to our fossil fuel addiction. And you know, it's a bit like you know, switching your mortgage from a Countrywide Financial to Bear Stearns, and you haven't solved the problem, and you haven't really achieved any more security, other than the fact that you've kept Shell and BP and Total and Exxon in business a little bit longer. So what's the point? And the Americans are seriously starting to ask, you know, questions, as are the Europeans. And so I think ultimately, it's action in the United States and policy changes in the United States that will ultimately force a debate in Canada about the pace and scale of tar sands development, which is sometimes what happens. I mean, a country gets so absorbed in itself that it can't really see its way out of a major problem until other people from outside, you know, kind of explain in very clear terms, you know what? What you're doing is not going to work, and you know, maybe Canada shouldn't become another Saudi Arabia. Maybe that would be just as destructive to Canada as it would be to the United States.
Now, Andrew, Nikki Falk, we've only got a few minutes left, but I would like you to analyze and talk about dirty oil and bloody oil. What's the difference, and what do those terms mean?
Well, by bloody oil, I'm referring to the fact that the United States has been dependent really on mediated oil since the 1970s. In the 1970s, domestic oil production in the United States peaked, and you know, there was the oil crisis of the 1970s, and the United States thought, okay, holy smokes, we don't have enough oil now here to meet domestic consumption needs, so we'll solve this problem by simply switching to oil from the Middle East, and we won't ask a lot of questions about what this transfer of wealth will mean in terms of politics in the Middle East. Well, it had huge implications, and with the result that a lot of that wealth was actually used to fund religious fundamentalists, and those religious fundamentalists have now funded groups that have declared war against the United States. And the United States realizes that finally, it took a while, but okay, well, you know, this is not a good position for us to be in. We need to switch sources of oil. They haven't started the really critical conversation, which is what Thomas Friedman has advocated, is that, you know, really the object for the United States is now to get off oil altogether.
Yes,
if it wants to remain a leader in global affairs, then it must be a leader in the renewable energy revolution.
Yes.
And in the interim, the thing is, okay, no, we're going to now switch to dirty oil. So what is dirty oil? Well, dirty oil is essentially unconventional oil. It's stuff that was too expensive to ever produce before. It is like bitumen, or it's oil shale, and this stuff, you know, has three times the greenhouse gas content of light oil. Yet it takes more energy to produce it. It's incredibly water intensive, and incredibly capital intensive. So there's nothing about this product that is sustainable. I mean, you've gone from a resource that was cheap and affordable to one that is expensive and whose environmental footprint is that much more dramatic. And so the transition from bloody oil to dirty oil is not one that's going to take the United States anywhere it really needs to go in either the short term or the long term. But for the oil and gas industry, this is an important transition. I mean, they realize that, you know, that they don't have a future unless they start to promote the rapid development of unconventional fuels.
Well, I love the way they use greenwashing, that BP, you know, paints its tankers green and its gas stations green because they're really into renewable energy and solar, which is an absolute fabrication. I don't know what will wake them up, really. I don't know.
Well, I think there are a number of things that are going to happen. I think that and we've already hit one oil shock in the last year and a half, and that's when oil reached $147 a barrel.
Yes.
And
yes.
Sort of the whole world's financial community started to shake and quake because
yes.
that's not sustainable. And so we've had a recession, and during the recession, we're consuming less fossil fuel, so we bring the price of oil down temporarily. But then we have these, industrial revolutions in India and China that are ongoing, and that will
yep.
bring back the price of oil, and then we'll have another shock. So I think
yep.
what we're going to see is just we're going to see more volatility, we're going to see more price shocks, and I think eventually we'll see more and more pressure from ordinary people in communities around the world on their governments to say, you know what, guys, this is crazy. We can't keep on going like this. We need to begin our transition as quickly as possible. And that transition will mean relocalizing food supplies. That transition will mean relocalizing industrial production. And this whole process will really result in the opposite of globalization, kind of a deglobalization, where the world reorients itself again, sort of slaps itself in the face, gets over this whole Disneyland experience of, I can consume whatever I want from whatever I want in any place in the globe, and begins to think, you know what, the planet is finite, and we have to live within our means in the places where we live. And I think that movement is very powerful, and it's ongoing, and it's happening right across the globe.
Yes, it is. Well, that's a wonderful, optimistic place to end this interview, Andrew. I thank you so much for outlining the problems in Canada. I was only partially aware of it. It's going to be useful for me for my next trip, but let alone educating people of Australia, the United States, and Canada about a huge problem which is really unaddressed by most people in the world today. And Canada holds actually one of the keys to a safe future, doesn't it?
I believe so.
I believe so.
Thank you very much, Helen. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I've really enjoyed this conversation.
Yeah. Well, maybe we'll do it again in 6 months when things have changed a bit, huh?
Okay, it's a deal.
Okay, it's a deal. Thank you very much, Andrew. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
My guest today on If You Love This Planet was award-winning journalist and author Andrew Nicky Falk. His latest book, The Tar Sands, Dirty Oil and the Future of the Continent, examines the world's largest energy project and recently won the 2009 Rachel Carson Environmental Book Award. The book was published by D&M Publishers in Canada and co-published with the David Suzuki Foundation. If you're enjoying these broadcasts and learning a lot and you want them to continue, we'd love you to help us. Comes back to the old question of money again, but if you go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org, there is a place where you could make a contribution, and we'd be very grateful. Thank you for listening again today, and we'll present a lovely new program full of information for you next week. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.